This is Reel 33, in spite of Mr. Moses' following announcement.
Mr. Gormley, Reel 32. You were back with your unit and had just come out of an action when in those very early days in the Alamein line when Rommel made a push to break through early on, very early on. The unit must have lost a great number of men.
We've practically lost every man that was in the battery. That was 120 odd men, plus the odds and sods at the end of the year. So we were because we as a unit had been completely surrounded before the battle in the Cauldron, and that was why we had such difficulty getting out. We couldn't carry wounded or anything like that, you know. And we've already been through that about the Cauldron.
We've been through the Cauldron and the retreat.
We had been completely surrounded. There was no way anybody could get in or out. So we've got through that lot. We've got through Tobruk, and when I was there, joined the Cameron Highlanders on a spur of a moment decision, and I came back as far as Alamein, and we go back to Alamein. Now we're back to Alamein. I'm just refreshing my own mind as I'm going. We've gone back to Alamein. I'm still with the Camels. I left them when I was picked up by the OP. And I've rejoined my regiment, which was in the line there at the time, with the 5th Indian Day. That's it. I'm up to where I want to be. And when I got back to the regiment, I was the Major took me up. Myself and Peter Lynn, who was a gunner with me, he took us up to see the colonel. We had a new colonel, by the way, because the other one had a dweller hat. And we had this new colonel, a fellow called Daniels, Colonel Daniels, from the RHA. He was an RHA man. And he came to us. I went up and saw him, and he asked me what had happened, and I told him in detail what had happened, and enumerated most of the wounded and the dead and that, you know. And after listening to my story, he bounces up to full sergeant immediately, and Peter Lynn, he bounces up to Bombardier. And I took the gun over from a lance sergeant that was there. He came from Sunderland, a lad called Jackie Richardson. And I took the gun over from him because he had actually been a long time ago driver RVA. And as we said in those days, we knew damn all about guns, except we knew how to fire them kind of style, you know. We were all concentrated as regards RVA. So when I got into this, I took the gun over and I always remember it. Thank God you've come. He said, I'm not bugging all about going with you. Like he said, we're sharp learners. I said, oh, it's all right, no problem. Like, you know. Because he'd actually come out as a reinforcement from England, you see. And one of the reinforcements that had joined us with this new battery. So we got on very well together, actually. And he did very well. We worked together very well.
So at this moment in time with your promotion, you were now in charge of a gun.
I was in charge of a gun now, yeah.
And the crew were working under you.
I was under number one gun, yeah. I had number one gun under my command. And everybody, like all the section, under me.
So what were the specific duties of being in charge of a gun?
Well, your specific duties were actually to keep everybody under control, to make sure that everybody understood what you were telling them and to let them know that you knew what you were doing, which poor Jackie couldn't do because the gunners knew more than we knew, you know. But never mind, he became a very good gunner as it happened, with a bit of training. But your main duties were like to keep everybody under control in your own section, you know, and you always got the working tickets. You know, you get them in everywhere you go, like, you know, get working tickets. What do you do?
That's people who wanted to take it easy,
Yeah.
get away with things.
Take the mickey and things like that, you know. How do you come here and be honest when we go, like, you know, we were here first kind of stuff. But that didn't work for me, you know. I must admit, like, I was cushy, but I knew I'd keep warm enough.
And your own particular duty on the gun, what was your duty?
Well, our duty was to, I kept the gun, when it rained and that was shouted down, you would pass that on to the gun and the sight who was laying the sight, which I more or less packed in, naturally, because I was in charge of the gun then. So, it'd pass on the range, angle of sight, everything, you know, and you saw it with that, the gunner, the lax was later was sight. He was doing that properly, and the man who opened the breach, the man who ran the shell game, everybody knew his job and he had to do it, and everybody, you know, had to keep everybody strictly under control.
So it was more of a watching them, what they were doing, and giving them orders all the time.
Yeah, just orders all the time, yeah. Every order came down, was immediately passed on, and everybody, of course, by that time, everybody knew what they should do, and you didn't really need to tell them, like, you get weaving, you know. And, we settled in there quite well, and I was settled in with a gun crew, and I actually had six Irishmen in my crew. Nobody else would have them. Mickey Raiden, Mickey Fleming, Joe Duffy, one name. The name just made me real up, you know. And they were all stumbling among the bloody shells. Like, you know, that was the smallest bloke among them. They always used to call me kids, you know. Even then, I still kicked everybody in the building, like, but I had no bloody mercy on them. It was funny, you know, because if one of them stepped out the line, I would hit him with a bloody hammer. And I did that, that's God's honest truth. I'm not ashamed to say it. You know, all these big Irish were squabbling among themselves, you know, and I would just give one of them a butt with a bloody hammer and tell them to shut up or whatever it wanted to do, like, with all their expletives and everything involved. And,
were they Northern Irish or Southern Irish?
Mixture.
So you'd have possibly Catholics and Protestants?
Yes, yes. But they've all been in there, I mean, like, 22 years, you know. And, I don't know if you should many times, I think one of them, oh, be Jesus, you're a queer little fella, you are, like, you're a queer little fella. I tell you, this motherfucker, he said, put your input in front of me. I don't want to bat him.
But they gelled together very well,
obviously. Well, they gelled together, yeah. Oh, great bunch of lads, like, really, you know. Although they were struggling and fighting among themselves, you know. There wasn't any animosity in it, if you understand what I mean, like. There's no animosity there. No, they worked together like hell. There's no one that would do anything in the world, but they thought that was very wonderful. Once they got there, down to bedrock with them, like.
What happened to you then after this particular action, early action, and you obviously got your gun? What happened to you next?
Well, as I say, we were more or less static in the line. We were on the sector facing the Roycey Bridge. Exactly where the cameras were, just on the other side. You know, I'd already left. And we were like counterbatting, doing a lot of counterbatting there. We had a lot of shelling and that going on. We had what we call sniping guns. And what the system of that was, an officer, an officer, could be anyone out there, would go out and up with the infantry. And he would spot machine gun posts, things like that. Then he would come back, and he would target everything. And he knew your target. And what he used to do, he would go up during the course of the night. And he always traveled up by night. He had to go through the minefields. And there was a way through the minefields. And what he would do, he would take about 20-30 rounds of ammo, And as soon as daylight came, and they knew because they knew the targets, they fired open sights at all these machine gun nests.
So you took the gun up at night?
We took the gun up at night. We didn't take a limber, we just took the gun. And the, all the shells was in there, in the wagon. And he kept the wagon there with you, you know. And so, as soon as daylight come, you know what you're firing at? Bam, 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 bam. As quick as you could get the pickers up, you throw the gun on the back of the wagon and away like hell, and they used to be, and all the petty shells used to come down on me where we fired from, you know.
So they wouldn't look forward to you growing up, the
no,
infantry?
No, they didn't really. But there were different places, and you never went back to the same place twice. You know, and there was other times, if you were caught, sometimes you got caught, and you had to camouflage everything up, and then just stick it there for the rest of the day, because you'd use them for the ammunition up that you had. And then you'd make your way back the next night.
So and you were involved in this kind of activity?
Yeah, well, partly everybody took a turn at it, you know. I didn't mind, I just enjoyed it, really. I've been out in the Alamein, I've been out on patrol. They would ask you for volunteers because the infantry were taking a hammering, you know. And they would ask you for volunteers, anybody volunteer to go out and do a patrol work, you know. I didn't mind doing it, now and again. I do it all the time, right?
And in those circumstances, did you go out with an infantry officer or whatever? Was it purely artillery men that went out?
We were artillery men, all volunteers, and we would go out and say, well, we'd take over this thing, and we would go out and we'd leave a password behind, you know, because you always have to have a password, otherwise you wouldn't have any shot of coming back. And you would just go out to listen. And if you could catch anybody, you'd bring them back, well, that was a fist of the mill.
And were these all day patrols or all night patrols?
No, night time patrols. And go more or less listening, see where the firing was coming from, things like that.
This is something you weren't trained for, were you,
well,
really?
We've been in the daylight first, you see. And we've been more or less semi trained anyway. And
do you remember any particular patrol that became interesting in any way?
Yes, I'll tell you one now. It's not a thing that I could ever forget because this fella, our lieutenant, Joe Yeeshwood, in fact, I banded him up and sent him away when he got hit. This was at Alamein as well. And we've got this fella, a chap called Burkett. He'd come straight out from England. And when we used to get to the minefield, what we used to do, when we came back through the minefield, we used to have coloured tape. And we used to run that through, which told you exactly where you want it. And you saw a fella walking in front, holding the tape in his hand. And you followed him all the way through the minefield with your gun. And not the limber, but with the gun and the carriage, you see. And this fella, Burkett, gets up. And of course, I'm in charge of the gun, mate. But he's got his head stuck over at the top, mate. I'm sitting alongside him. And he said to this lad that was on the wire as we got up to the minefield, he said, "Put that bloody wire to one side. I've already been up here. I know where I'm going." And he said, "Because of his truth." He said, "I know where I'm going." He said, "Put that bloody thing to one side. Jump up on the bloody mudguard," he said. We're getting behind time. We've got to get up there in time. I said, "You can't do that." I said, "It's impossible." I said, "We'll never get up. I know where I'm going. I've already been up here." He said, "You know, dead arrogant, you know." So, sure enough, this blood juice up on the bloody mudguard. And then we were set up. And about five minutes later, I stood short of this driver. A lad called Chuck Hartman. I said, "Stop that bloody wagon, Chuck. What's the matter?" I said, "We're in the middle of a bloody minefield." "We were in the middle of a bloody minefield." He'd actually driven us off the bloody track where he should have been, gone into this mine thing. And I just looked at him and I said, well, what are we going to do now, sir? No fool, well, he hadn't a bloody clue, like, you know. I don't know how I come to do this. I said, I bloody told you that you should have followed the bloody wire that we put on and left him alone and walked and just gone through a walking pace, you know, that's all you needed to, just to get up where you were going. And we was in such a pretty rush to get there. So anyway, I said, one of the lads said, give one of them bloody bears. God's true, he said. And I got on the, I was standing on that bloody step, you know, and there was near me, I was going to jump down there. And I prodded all the way around that bloody thing. I got about 4 foot square all the way around. I thought, oh, well, at least there's buggers all down there, you know, getting down that deep, you know. And so I gingerly stepped off the bloody wagon, and I still wouldn't where I was going to get into the arse blown up like this. And anyway, I was all right when I got there. And I worked my way up the side of that wagon. I took three bloody mines out. How the hell would miss them? I do not know. I took three bloody mines out of this side. I got round the front. And I took another bloody three out the other side. And there was two bloody mines underneath, you know. I said, bloody hell, what the hell am I going to do? And of course, the other lad then, you know, I'd set them right, following behind me, like, and do what I'm doing, like, you know. And so we went up alongside the gun, and we prodded them out. We got another three or four out of there. And then we walked up, made our way back to where the tops of the gun had come down, and we still prodded all the way as we went. We only got another two out of that, or something like that. And then I said, right, wheel the bloody gun back. I said, just wheel the bloody gun back. So they got out of the trail and pushed it back until we got it back onto the track again. Maybe 2.5 hours it took us, you know, to do all this. You've got to be very careful what you're doing. And we got the gun onto the track. I said, no, I said, because we checked all around there, that was only what we had left was beneath the wagon. So I said to Joe, keep your fingers crossed, and for God's sake, just come back bloody straight. Go back exactly straight. We'll clear everything away, and we'll leave them, but we'll not take a chance on that still. We'll back, and I'll just let them, you know, I'll just back them back like that, like, you know, till he got clear. I said, right, straight back onto the truck. So we got back on the truck, and I thought, well, there's no way we're bloody going up there now, because by the time we got up where we were going, there wouldn't have been time to even drop into action. We would have been in full daylight, you know. So I said, right, we're going back. Oh, no, we can't. I said, we are. We're going back. We're going back a bit to the position. I said, so when I got back, it's back one step. What's happened? What are you going to do back here this time? And I said, he'll explain it to you, sir. I left him to do the explanation. I said, he'll explain it to you, sir. I said, it was impossible to get up there. I said, we'd have been going up there in broad daylight. I said, nah, we couldn't afford to do it. But the idiots, man, idiots. They will not be bloody told. I've got many more tales, not only about him, but others, you know. But that was a fact out there, and that was a really hairy, bloody situation to be able to tell
them. As artillery men, had you had any training in bayonet identification or bayonet search for mines?
No, we didn't have any training, but we knew what to do when we were in a minefield. You understand what I mean? Everybody got to know that. You just knew that the only way you could get out if you were a captain was to feel your way out, you know. You couldn't look at it, nothing like that. No way you could look at it. Yeah.
Can you describe the line or the position of the line that you were in? Presumably you were wired and mined in. You were behind wire and mined.
We had our own mine. We had our own mines in front of us, in front of the infantry, that way. We didn't have any mines around where we were, you know. But all the infantry were all wired in, and that. Well, let's see. The Australians are right in the top end on a salient. They were on a big salient in the very top end. They pushed the salient right through to the right into the German lines, actually, and they held it and all. Pretty marvellous the way they did it and all. And then, what was in front of that? I don't know whether it was the New Zealanders that were next.
And this is coming.
Then there was the 4th Indian Div and the 5th Indian Div. Oh, that's right. There was the 4th Indian Div, the 5th Indian Div, and we were on the, on this big Blue Isep Ridge. There was the two Indian divisions together. And then the New Zealanders came. This was like the line coming down from top. That was the secret end coming down the top. And then there was the New Zealanders at the bottom. There was another brigade further down. Can't remember what that one is.
And then that would get up to the depression, which was that end, wasn't it?
And right at the very bottom end was the regiment that I joined later, the 4th RHA. You know. They were in the bottom end. They were like an independent thing, command.
So you say you're on this ridge. How high was it? And how? No,
well,
above.
For a ridge, like a desert ridge, I should say, it'll probably be about 500-600 feet high. It was a proper ridge, you know,
So you'd have pretty good observation.
Oh yes. Well, you were on that ridge, and that's why I wanted it. That's why I wanted it. I mean, he was desperate. He tried 2 or 3 times to break through there. But, and of course, then, just not long after that, I think that's as much as I can remember about the line, on that line going down. And of course, there was the Panzer Divs and that on the other side.
Could you see the German positions from where you were on the ridge?
Not from where I could see them, no. Our OP could see them. The observation officer, he could see them, but we never saw them. You know, I mean, I could see them when I was up at the conference. I watched the very tanks coming across the road, just like coming over here, you know.
And you're back to 25 pounders now, were you?
Yeah, back on the 25 pounders. And,
you're talking about counter battery work. How did that work?
They would fire at us, and we would fire at them. And we all knew where, near enough where each other was. You had big gun pits, don't you know? A gun pit as big as this. You had a gun dug in there, all sandbagged up, you know.
As large as this room?
Oh, yeah, as large as this room.
And how?
Not as deep, probably about 4 or 5 feet high. And it would all be sandbagged in, like this, because you were in a static position, you see.
So just the barrel of the gun would be showing, in effect?
The barrel of the gun showing, like, you know, and they were just like us. They could throw the shells within a 50-yard radius. But it was finding that 50-yard and finding the right one, you know. So you
would see an enemy gun flash, or?
Oh, yes, yeah. And they could tell that.
And how did you zone in on that? I mean, what was the process of actually identifying that position?
Oh, well, you'd have to go to the OPAC for that, mm-hmm. because they had the maps and everything, and they would take a bearing, compass bearing, on where the flash came from. And immediately, of course, everything was on a grid, and they knew exactly where that man had fired from. And they would just send down the range and the angle of sight and everything, and you weigh it all up, elevation, angle of sight and range, and you would fire one, and then you would fire another one, and you would fire maybe the shells at, say, about half a mile apart, even, if you were in any doubt, and you'd see where one landed, where the other, and you could make a correction immediately. And take it up, so that you would get over the middle of the diesel and say, well, that's it, that's where he is, and X number of rounds gunfire, you know.
And they would be doing the same with your gun.
They'd be doing the same with yes, yeah. As soon as they saw a flash of the gun, they'd have the compass bearing on, and that would give them an idea of where they was. And they would look at the map and they would work the range out, and they would give the range two ranging shots, and that's all you needed. And you could just straight up, more or less straight up.
So if you had an enemy shell that exploded in front of you, and the next one behind you, you would know where the third was coming.
You knew where it was, well, you knew where it was going to land within 50 yards anyway.
And what did you do? Scatter from that position?
Oh, boy, just stop where you were. You never moved. You didn't go out there. You didn't leave anything behind you.
It must have been quite a frightening thing, though, to know that he'd got your range.
Oh, but as I say, we knew as well as they knew that he's got to hit that fifth. He's only got, like, the width of this room, say, 15 foot, like a 15-foot radius. So if he could have dropped it in there, you're going to be looking like kind of...
Did it become, then, in this kind of action, did it become a question of who could get the first one on?
More or less, you know, yes.
He's firing at you, you're firing at him.
I'll prove it in just a moment. Because this has got us into, probably August. From July, as we came back in Alameen from July, I came back to the regiment. Yeah, that would take us through to August. And then we went on, we got this sudden call with what you call a firecracker. Wherever the bloody muck was going, we were pulled out and we'd been doing that all the time, as we realised from that. Wherever it was, we were pulled out and sent to the place. And we got this sudden order to draw away from the Wyset Ridge that we'd been on and make for a place called Alum Halfa Ridge, which was further back, but on the right hand, as I'm looking at it, on the right hand flank. And this was the key where the Wyset Ridge was the key to the Alameen line. This was the key to the to crossing the sand sea. There was a big sand sea there, and they thought it was impossible to cross because of the quicksands and all sorts of stuff. And yet, one of the guys will come across with a set of bloody tanks.
This wasn't the Katara Depression, which was farther down, was it?
No. This is the Katara Depression. This was the Katara Depression as it was known, but this fella had been out on one of these jock columns, which we did as well later on. He'd been out on one of these jock columns, and this was named after the Berryford Pierce, not Berryford Pierce, Jock Campbell. He was the brother that formed these things. We used to send them away behind the enemy lines. Eh? So we got them to, anyway, we were called back to this Alum Halfa Ridge to reinforce the parts of the 7th Armoured Division, which were already there. And it was just as well somebody had thought of it, because we woke up this morning and bloody well, look across this Katara Depression, they couldn't see the bloody tanks. There was tanks, bloody motorized infantry, the whole lot, they're coming across like a swarm of bloody ants, all across this desert.